in association with the trend that was a bit more evident yesterday, I also didn't look terribly closely at the title of the talk that was expected of me, which was the very high redshift IGM. However, in the strengthening of the trend, I didn't actually look at this close enough to make a difference to my talk. So what I'm really going to be talking about is stressing the metals in the high redshift IGM. I don't think this is too unreasonable. We already heard yesterday on some of the issues on reionization in the high redshift IGM. Everson's really, of course, discovered metals in the IGM. The question of where they come from has obviously been around. And of course, it's also been known right from the start that the selection of origins is likely to be true at any given spot. However, of course, we do see metals down at a range of overdensities, in particular, also somewhat into the underdense regions. As we saw, we've been seeing for the last couple of days, certain of the formation mechanisms have trouble with that. So the whole aim of the study is to try and understand if we can understand the formation of metals as a function of overdensity and redshift. Perhaps we can begin to get some handle on which mechanisms are more important at which redshifts. And as we've just been hearing, this is a very old slide, just to illustrate the same stuff as Chuck was talking about just now, that Lyman-Bick galaxies at a redshift of 3 do, of course, affect the intergalactic medium by means of superwinds. And also, as we've just been hearing, that at least for the higher column density systems, there is a correlation between the galaxies and the carbon-4. Some of this, of course, due by winds, some, as he's just been saying, from the fact that they both occur in overdense regions. But whatever it is, it does, of course, raise the question of what portion of the enrichment of the IGM at a redshift of 3 comes from previous enrichment compared to enrichment at the time at a redshift of 3 itself. These are just illustrations. So in this talk, I'm going to be hitting the two key issues which are more or less the state of play in this game just now. One, how do the metals evolve with redshift? And that's up to the highest redshifts we can reach with optical spectra, which is a bit more than 5, considering carbon-4 systems, a bit more than 5.5, considering silicon-4 systems. And, of course, a very key question, to what overdensity in the IGM do we still see metals? In other words, are the voids themselves enriched? Of course, as we all know, the 8 and 10 meter telescopes, that's UVES and VLT, spectrographs in the 8 and 10 meter telescopes, UVES and VLT, high res on Keck, produce beautiful high signal to noise spectra. And of course, everyone shows this state of the art Q1422 spectrum, which of course is very high signal to noise. Of course, you should bear in mind this is just one spectrum. And it's a lens spectrum to boot, so possibly a bit of an oddity. So the goal in this is to try and make a better sample of high signal-to-noise quasars at roughly this redshift of 3. As you go to higher redshifts, of course, you need very red-sensitive detectors. And what we've been using for this is ESI on Keck, which is not perhaps perfectly ideal for the subject since the resolution is low. However, it is doable, and you can, again, with work, reach beautiful high signal-to-noise levels on these high redshift quasar spectra. And the new thing, of course, that's come along is the recent upgrade on high-res, and this shows data of a small portion of the spectrum on ER2237 at a redshift of 4.5. This is about a month old. This was in more or less the first run of the new high-res. It shows how nicely you can do a job cleaning this spectrum up. It just shows also how rich the carbon-4 forest is in this small portion of the spectrum. And the great thing is that with the vastly increased sensitivity at the red end, you're now talking about being able to get up to a resolution of 67,000 at these redshifts, which is going to completely revolutionize what we can do at the high redshift end. As I say, we've only had one run on this yet, so we've got a couple of spectra. Len showed one yesterday. You can also do this at the very high redshifts. And so, of course, as time goes on, we're going to see many more of these filling in the high redshift end. And you do need very high signal to noise for this spectrum, extremely high signal to noise. And in some sense, it's no use looking at low signal to noise portions of the spectrum. The information just simply isn't there. And this just illustrates, if you're going to do the problem by Voigt profile fitting, then for a signal to noise of 200 in a 20 kilometer a second window, you get these kind of limits on the column density that you can detect. For carbon 4, it's just under 12, which is comparable to what we saw in the very high signal to noise spectrum in Ellison et al. Back then. Okay. This is for a six sigma detection in carbon 4, which is reasonable because you need to also identify the other member of the doublet. And then if you're going to look at other ionization states of other systems, which you want to do to figure out the ionization correction, then you also need comparable high sensitivity. Right? But of course, this is in some sense just the minimum you can do. The hope is that with automatic methods, you could push, in fact, much further down into the sensitivity than you see given here. And this is the impetus for trying to develop fully objective, fully statistical methods for solving this, other than just simple Voigt profile fitting. So, as I say, we've been trying to develop a sample of high redshift quasars. The line is just, this is roughly ordered with redshift, high redshift here, low redshift here. The line just cuts off the instrument used. Above here is ESI, below is high res. And we're aiming to try and get a sample with a signal to noise of about 200 at least. Okay, and our best sample at the moment is still around a redshift of 3. We have a set of 5 very good quasars, redshift signal to noise 200 and above. At both lower and higher redshifts, we're talking smaller than that. But essentially, the only two, just to get back to the high-res point, essentially the only two quasars we've observed so far with the new high-res upgrade are BR2237 at redshift of 4.5 and 1946 at a redshift of 3. And the signal to noise is not great yet, but remember this is only one night of observing. Okay. These are signal to noises at redshift 1250 and 1400 angstrom. And it's signal to noise in a 20 kilometer a second window. So the whole sample is 27 quasars, but quite a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is in our very high redshift sample, near a redshift of 3. Okay, so this is just a reprise of how one did this several years ago. And classically, you do identify optically, you visually identify carbon 4 doublets and Voigt profile fit. And this is just to remind everyone of this is from what it was like a couple of years ago. The open symbols are from Ellison et al. In a high signal to noise spectrum at the time. Closed symbols are from a whole sample of other, from a whole big sample at the time, but over the same redshift range, around about 2 to 3.5. And you see, of course, the carbon 4 column density distribution rising to smaller column density until you turn over somewhere above log n carbon 4 of 12 in this sample, a little bit lower in the high redshift sample. This is just incompleteness. And this is best fit in the Ellison et al. Sample with a power law of index minus 1.44. And the thing was, as we found just splitting it up into redshift bins, that the carbon 4 distributions seem to be extremely constant as you go from redshift 1.5 to redshift 5.5, suggesting that there really is not much change up to a redshift of 5.5. And this is all Voigt profile fitting. And then the simplest thing you can do, the most model independent thing you can do, is just turn this into an omega for the ion, just in a similar way as was done for H1. I won't go through all this, everyone knows about it. But assuming a very simple ionization correction, carbon 4 to carbon, silicon 4 to silicon, we assumed a factor of 2 back then. The work of Shea et al. Suggests that this is probably somewhat larger, more like an order of magnitude. But if you do that, you get minimum metallicity estimates relative to solar of these values throughout. And then if you just plot this up, these omegas, you see this astonishingly flat trend in omega carbon 4 and omega silicon 4 all the way from 1.5 to 5.5, with perhaps, this is now the Pettini et al. Point from last year, so there's good agreement between those at this redshift, with some suggested of turn down in carbon 4 and especially in silicon 4 at the highest redshifts. Now, of course, these are minimum metallicities, and everyone stresses this, and of course it's true. At any redshift, the real metallicity is likely to be higher. Of course, if ionization corrections change with redshift, then you're going to see trends in this. But the turn down at high redshift is going to be caused either by a metallicity drop or by a change in ionization. Okay. Now the second question is the very low density forest enriched with metals. And here, you really do have to go into more direct methods than Voigt profile fitting, and this just illustrates again an old slide. Down here, you've got to use the so-called pixel optical depth methods to get you further down into the forest than the Voigt profile fitting will take you. And this just shows what this was first analyzed by Ellison et al. 2000 and is consistent with the much more detailed reanalysis by Shea et al., which I will talk a little bit about. Okay. So this is the impetus for moving to more directly statistical methods. Obviously, you would like a more objective way of analyzing this data, and also a way that gives you improved sensitivity. And that the best way to do this is with the so-called pixel optical depth correlation methods, which basically initial idea was to correlate Lyman alpha and the minimum of carbon 4 optical depths at the carbon 4 doublet positions. I put that up first, okay. You trace the H1 optical depth using the Lyman series and you correlate with the carbon 4 absorption line optical depth. This was back in 1998. This method, as everyone knows, of course, was taken over by Shea and collaborators and produced a very detailed understanding of the intergalactic medium. And this is just to illustrate from their method paper. Basically, you're just looking for excess of carbon 4 signal and modeling how far down in Lyman alpha this is going to get you. And this again just illustrates that high signal to noise is extremely important. The difference between signal to noise of 100, which is the solid line, and signal to noise of 25, which is the dashed line, makes a big difference in where you recover your carbon 4 signal. And basically, they're saying that you get down to tau Lyman alpha less than 1, which in the simple model that relates tau Lyman alpha to overdensity corresponds to an overdensity less than 1, something like 0.4. And that's what you can do with the original pixel optical depth method. I'm sure you will talk more about this tomorrow. Okay. All right, but now in the spirit of the title of the talk, which was the very high redshift IGM, it should be realized that there is a limitation with the pixel optical depth method, namely that, and everyone's seen this already many times, as you move to high redshift, you begin to get severe blending in the forest. And as the H1 forest information disappears after above a redshift of 5, and indeed is getting pretty ratty by a redshift of 5, then your original pixel optical depth method is not going to be of any use to you anymore, because you have no H1, or not with difficulty correlating the H1 with the carbon 4. And to put it another way, we do still see absorption line systems at a redshift of about 6, but there isn't any H1 to correlate it with. Okay? So this was the impetus for developing, and I should say that this is definitely work in progress, but it's the impetus for developing a slightly different method of using the optical depth comparison techniques, which we call superposed optical depths, which very nicely lends itself to being called superpod. Not my fault. this uses only the doublet information in whatever ion you're talking about, carbon-4 or silicon-4. And essentially, you just find all the positions in the optical depth versus wavelength plot where the ratio of the optical depths in the two members of the doublet approximately satisfies the doublet condition of 2:1. And this just illustrates roughly what we're doing here. The bottom, you have the 1548 optical depths, carbon-4, obviously. 1548 optical depth. Above, 1550 optical depth shifted to the same position. And then the top, we have shows the combined signal from the two members of the doublet here. The criterion is simply we accept anywhere where there is a doublet ratio in these two things, approximately 2. I'll show in a minute what I mean by approximately 2. This line here is just to show the scale, which is an optical depth of 0.01, because it's not on here. This doesn't represent a cutoff. In fact, there is no optical depth cutoff. It's just a doublet ratio criterion. You can see this slightly differently here. This is just plotting 1550 optical depth against 1548 optical depth, and selecting a fixed within a fixed set of ratios here. The width of the tram lines is somewhat arbitrary, yes. I mean, too narrow and you reject weak systems, too wide and you introduce too much contamination. By trial and error, we've figured out that a range of doublet ratios somewhere between 0.25 and 1 works best. And you can see, obviously, at high optical depths, you can see the excess signal quite easily. But of course, the aim is to probe sort of down to maybe an carbon-4 optical depth down to 0.01 or 1548 optical depth. But of course, the aim is to probe further down into the noise. And you can also estimate, of course, your contamination by moving to off positions, that's to say, generating false doublets with not quite the same separation. You do this many times. This is just a single example, of course. And of course, again, at high optical depths, it's easy to see that there's nothing there. But once you get down to the noise level, you're beginning to add many spurious systems down here. And the signal is the on position minus a whole set of averages of the off position. And this just shows what we get in a single case. This is for HS1946, which is kind of at the low end of the high signal-to-noise spectra that we have. The solid line is a distribution of optical depths of carbon-4. And the dashed is the average of 20 artificial doublets. And you see there is excess signal down to something like 1/200th in 1548 optical depth. And this just shows, you know, the signal that you're talking about is the actual minus the random. Okay. Of course, as well as signal recovery, we do also have to worry about line recovery. You worry about lines falling on, lines blending, lines falling on bad areas of the chip. You worry about signal to noise issues. So in in the classic way, we simply add in lines and see what fraction we recover. And this just shows a couple of examples. Basically adding a couple of lines at log n of 12.25, a couple at log n of 11.75. And basically we're doing well down to about this level of log n carbon-4 of 11.75, where you're beginning to be slightly incomplete. You only recover 3 of 4 of those. Okay. So one thing you can do with this is go back to and essentially mimic the Voigt profile fitting technique by generating artificial clouds. Generate artificial clouds by essentially percolating through the optical depth distribution. In this case, it's with a width of 100 kilometers a second, so anything contiguous within 100 kilometers a second is considered a cloud. What you're seeing here, and then generate the column density distribution again, as you would for Voigt profile fitting. What you see here, the open symbols are the pod recovery, what you get. The closed symbols are corrected for incompleteness, as I was just talking about. And the circles are what you get by just literally Voigt profile fitting on the same set of objects, which in this case is our good high five high signal-to-noise spectra around about a redshift of 3. The dashed line is the fit to that, which is slope of minus 1.44. If you go up to a higher slope, it's definitely too steep. That's a solid line. And again, you're just comparing this with what I showed before, the state-of-the-art void profile fitting, and essentially it compares very well. And again, perhaps this is not the best way to use this technique, but it's one thing to try. We now have something like half a dex, some greater sensitivity. So with that, and using this artificial cloud generation, we just went through and redid the column density distributions at the various redshifts, and now you see with this extra sensitivity, we're talking, you know, really extremely invariant column density distributions. And again, you can do the same thing with omegas. And you do, in fact, see the same thing, extremely flat omega carbon 4. This is just carbon 4. At both column densities from 10 to the 12 to 10 to the 15, that's the solid boxes, and also at 10 to the 13 to 10 to the 14. But of course, that's not really what you want to do. You would want to do this without artificially breaking things up into clouds, and of course we're not required to do that. We can do this directly from the optical depth distribution, and that's what's shown here. The boxes are carbon 4 and the diamonds are silicon 4, and essentially you do get the same answer, but you're not seeing turndown until the highest redshift point possible turndown. It's no void profile fitting. So just to make the point that yes, we may be turning down at the highest redshifts, but to say again, we do still see metal systems at these redshifts. I better speed up a bit because I'm out of time. But to remind you again that at the highest redshifts, we are talking about a somewhat lower signal-to-noise sample, so we may be missing things at the lower column density end, which is perhaps accounting for that somewhat. I would be surprised if it accounted for it enough to make it fully invariant, but that's just a hunch at this point. Okay. However, the turndown, of course, could be due to changes in ionization, and to investigate this, we can also look at other ionization states. So this is carbon 2 to carbon 4 evolution. Here, the boxes are in fact clouds, carbon 2 artificial clouds generated in this way, again with a calculation width of 100 kilometers a second. And you see that at any redshift there is a spread in carbon 2 to carbon 4, so obviously a spread in ionization. And the trend, though I haven't plotted it on here, is more neutral at higher column density systems. But if you just compute the red dots, the median value in any redshift bin of the carbon two computed from optical depths, then you see very little evolution in carbon two to carbon four. This is very similar to what shared I was finding with carbon three to carbon four in their analysis. However, at the risk of causing trouble, I'm also going to show silicon 4 to carbon 4 evolution, and here we do still see a very strong signal. Okay, again, the boxes are clouds, and here the one we've outlined which are the high column density systems, and again we've constructed the median from the optical depths, and we do in fact see a very strong evolution in silicon 4 to carbon 4. It's still there in this data, and it's still there very strongly. The KS test, which of course is conducted on the clouds, not on the optical depth, shows that the distribution from redshift 2 to 3 is very distinct from the distribution redshift 3.5 to 4.5. This, again, is probably due to change in the shape of the ionizing spectrum, more galaxian at high redshift to more AGN-dominated at low redshift. Okay, I have very little time to say this, but this is the nub of the thing. Superpod doesn't use H1, okay? However, it is possible to invert superpod to find the H1 at the carbon 4 positions. Now, it doesn't use H1, so perhaps that's a less efficient thing to do, but the fact that you're only tracing the H1 at the narrower carbon 4 positions is perhaps a more efficient thing to do, since you're not adding noise in the wings of the H1. And this is shown here. You can construct carbon 4 to Lyman alpha as a function of Lyman alpha optical depth at the carbon 4, corresponding carbon 4 position. That is the solid boxes with 1 sigma error bars, they're just very small up here. And you see you can recover signal down to a Lyman alpha optical depth of about 0.3. Okay. And it's nice to know what this might mean, where the signal might be coming from, and this is just, again, a very old slide, and this is just to illustrate that at higher column densities, we do see, as everyone knows, a spread of about a dex in carbon 4 to H1. And if you model this here, you can sort of get an idea of what's happening. Essentially, SuperPOD in this incarnation accepts everything with a 1548 optical depth greater than about 0.005 and essentially rejects everything below it. So that's one window function. And then we've modeled the carbon 4 to H1 with essentially a normal distribution, log normal distribution, with a width of, I think on here is 1 dex. And obviously as you move from high tau Lyman alpha to lower tau Lyman alpha, the overlap with your selection function is going down, and this is giving you the reduced signal of carbon 4 to Lyman alpha. This does illustrate two things. One, that high signal to noise is crucial. You only have to move this rejection window over by a bit, and down at the low tau Lyman alpha, you're not going to see anything. Okay. So this high signal to noise is very, very key. Also, of course, you want to know what you're seeing is this part of the distribution, and so, of course, the width of the distribution makes a difference. And this is illustrated on here. The diamonds are distribution with this mean carbon 4 to H1, 4.5 times 10 to the minus 3, and a width of 0.8 dex. If you go to narrow, just width of 0.4 dex, just repeating what I've said, this wimps out at higher Lyman alpha optical depths, and you don't see it anymore. If you go to wider width of 1.2 dex, then you get excess signal at higher optical depths that you don't see. So just doing this somewhat crudely, the best fits seem to be given by, as I say, this average carbon 4 to H1 and a width of 0.8 dex seem to be the best fit to the system. Now this is quite a startling result. That's good, I've got about 2 minutes left to say. What we're seeing is that we're seeing enrichment down to a tau Lyman alpha of about 0.3. If we just turn that into an overdensity the same way as Shea et al. Did, this is an overdensity of something like minus 0.75, which is a fraction of a dex somewhat deeper than the Shea et al. It's actually very equivalent. Perhaps just a fraction of a dex, somewhat more sensitive than that. This, but of course we're only measuring the tail of the distribution. This says nothing at all about what might happen to the rest of the distribution if you think you have some reason for supposing that this distribution is cut away, then you can't make such strong statements. But what the strong statement you can make is that counting only in the overlap region with this width of 0.8 dex that we've assumed is the best fit, then you get a carbon 4 to Lyman alpha of something like 4.5 or 5 times 10 to the minus 4. And that's an absolute minimum, because we don't really know, of course, what's happening in the rest of the distribution. And so just to conclude, we've objectively analyzed a sample of high signal to noise spectra from Z equals 2 to Z equals 5. We can repeat that the omega carbon 4 and silicon 4 do remain relatively constant, with perhaps some turn down at the highest redshifts. Carbon 2 to carbon 4 is nearly constant from redshift 2 to 5, but silicon 4 to carbon 4 does increase with redshift, and the break between the z less than 3 and z greater than 3.5 is highly significant. And that there are metals present at a redshift of 3. I should have said that this was all at our highest signal to noise sample at a redshift of 3, down to a log delta of approximately minus 0.75. However, this says nothing about what Renu was talking about this morning, hot high delta systems mimicking low delta systems. This is just assuming a simple conversion. Okay, so thank you.
Two things I want to say. One is that even if the ionization correction is independent of redshift, there's still a danger that you're comparing apples and pears, in the sense that if you're looking at a given ion, you're always looking at roughly the same physical densities. But if you're looking at different redshifts, it corresponds to different overdensities. So you're saying then you're looking at metallicities that may correspond to different types of environments at the different redshifts. The other thing I want to say is it's more a question. I made this point before at this conference, that if you do silicon 4 over C4, what we found in a paper that Anthony Geary was the lead author on, is that if you do silicon 4 over C4 as a function of C4, you find a very strong correlation. So we found if you want to do it as a function of redshift, you better make sure that you have a very small C4 bin in which you're computing silicon 4 over C4. Because if at higher redshift your signal noise is somewhat different, for example, than at lower redshift, your typical C4 may be different, and therefore you might find a different silicon 4 over C4. And I saw from your plot that you're using a lower limit only to the C4 optical depth. So the question is, have you also tried to measure the evolution in silicon 4 over C4 for a narrow bin?
No, this is essentially everything, right, as you're okay. pointing out, including the high column density things. And with the artificial cloud generation, it's going to bin everything into a cloud that it can find. Okay, so this is definitely just throwing everything in, including all the high column density systems, and we haven't done it in this way you're describing yet.
So one question I had, it looked like you got down to slightly lower H1 column densities, and I wondered, it also though looked like your quasar sample was a little bit higher signal to noise than ours. Mm-hmm. So I was curious as to whether you had improvement, whether you had compared how low signal to noise or how low column density you could get using this new doublet method versus just the old method of using all the pixels.
No, we haven't done it directly. This is kind of preliminary work. It's an obvious thing to do. Okay. But I would say off the top of the head that perhaps the pre-filtering by choosing the doublet first and then comparing with the Lyman alpha is the obviously intuitive reason for perhaps getting slightly greater sensitivity.
Yeah. On the other hand, you lose some of you're making a cut, and then those low column density at those very low carbon optical depths, you don't really have enough information to do your cut. So you are you're keeping good information, but you're also throwing away a lot of
information. I know both systems do that, and I haven't looked in detail.
So I'd be curious as to which.
Yeah. I also would say I don't think SuperPOD is just a cheap shot. I mean, I think at any given circumstance, one method or the other is probably going to be superior, right? Yeah. I mean, where the H1 is less blended, as it is in lower redshift, then it's quite possible that original pod is a superior method. And the impetus for moving to this other method was to be able to push it to higher redshifts, which we can do up to about a redshift of 4.5. We just haven't done it yet.
And another just comment I wanted to make was the silicon 4 to carbon 4 you showed is very... I think that's a very nice thing to do, especially at high redshift, because you don't have to know anything about the H1. And I was curious, as I couldn't quite see on your plot how high redshift you would push to in silicon 4 over carbon 4.
It's median. It's about just over 4.5.
And I guess two questions would be, what's limiting that, and then also, have you looked at the spread? And we found some very interesting results on the distribution of silicon 4 over carbon 4, which indicates that there doesn't seem to be much scatter in that ratio. And that can constrain scatter in the UV ionizing background as well as scatter in the enriching mechanism. So that's an interesting thing to look at.
Yeah, we'll get to it. Yeah.
If I read it right from one of the figures, you said the frequency distribution of the C4 lines is about power law of minus 1.5, minus 1.8. Is that about right?
Yep.
So a couple questions then. What confidence do you have that omega C4 is not, has converged, given that the integral of that frequency distribution does not converge? And perhaps more importantly, when you're going to go to do a ionization correction from C4 to omega C, since that integral over the frequency distribution is dominated by the high C4 end, we need to be thinking primarily about what the ionization correction is for the high C4 end.
No, I understand both of those problems. These have always been systemic problems of doing it this way. Now, I always have to stress that this is a minimum omega carbon 4. Obviously, the extensive modeling that's been done in other circumstances is probably more accurate. But, as you said, their results are consistent with our results. So I don't think there's any inconsistency in there. I mean, I take your point exactly, and these are obviously the difficult.
But if omega is dominated by the high NC4 end of the distribution, it doesn't matter if you use the pixel technique and try and get down into the noise. Okay, it's just then the omega is dominated just by the 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15s.
No, but we also want to find out how far
you can
go into the low over density.
That's another issue, but not an issue.
There are two issues in this topic.
Not, but not an issue of the mass density in C4.
Yeah.
So something that doesn't have ionization issues is the line width, and you can get that very quickly from a spectra, right? And including the couple you've already got at very high Z. So, do the carbon 4 lines or the clustering or the widths, do they show any change at all with redshift? I mean, even though that's not the IGM temperature, it's a clue as to whether or not things are changing. Zoltan was asking for that this morning.
I haven't really looked into that in great detail.
Okay, one question. So actually we have a bit of a time for kind of a more general discussion if somebody wants to.
Yeah, please.
Amil?
So I was just wondering if the scenario that you're outlining of a fairly constant metallicity is in disagreement with what Chuck was saying, where, down to fairly low carbon 4 column densities, he seems to be associated with galaxies and you seem to be seeing the enrichment.
Well, of course, that was the impetus for doing it in the first place. Obviously, at face value, yes, there would be, but then when you have to know what the ionization correction is. Really, this is just the minimum metallicity. Did you want to add anything to that? No. I wish I knew the answer to that, but, I don't.
Oh, one point. I thought he meant I had to give it to someone. I'll say something. One possible solution to that problem is that some people already referred to in their talks is that those metals that come out of those galaxies may be in hot gas that you don't see in these ions.
Yeah, but if we believe Renu from this
morning,
but the
C4 that
will look
Chuck sees, that's a point I was trying to make earlier. It's not. I don't think there's been a proof of a causal connection between those because the Lyman-Bray galaxies are obviously the very bright ones that are seen, and they're known to be highly clustered, so there's probably lots of little galaxies around them that we can't see. So maybe Chuck can say something about that. Why can't those satellite galaxies be responsible for that C4, for example?
Surely the issue here is you're continuously making star-formed galaxies, all of which are injecting carbon-4 into the local black medium, but unless you somehow get rid of it, right, you always expect there should be a upward trend in the being metals, so it has to be, right? I mean, you're adding.
Sure,
right.
Not an omega is invisible now.
You have to make the metals invisible in some way, and the only way to do that is either by making them hot, right, or by dropping them back onto the galaxy, right, or something like that.
They are
quite true. Yeah. Yeah. So it's actually a hot problem.
Well, there is some issues there, but the question I asked Tony is also relevant to that. Are you looking at different overdensities? So yeah, at redshift 5, you're really looking at different types of environments. If you look at C4, then you are at redshift 2. You're looking at the same physical densities, but different overdensities, if you're looking at photoionized
C4. Of course, and as you measure over the carbon flow distribution, you measure over the H1 column density, which is different than the redshift, and you have to write about that. Right? But the fact that the metals
so if we're looking at the same densities, the different redshifts, that the higher redshift, it's actually lower over density. Right? So it seems like if you have constant metallicity, it's maybe a very stupid question. If you have constant metallicity as a function of Coulomb density, it actually goes the wrong way. Right? So the metals go from lower density regions to higher density regions. So you have the same metallicity at high redshift in lower density regions, and you have the same metallicity and lower redshift in high density regions. So.
I'm also interested in this little area. I mean, when I looked at the simulations that Ren Yu showed many times this morning, I saw the gas falling in. Right? I saw it falling in, so I saw the higher density regions occupying a smaller fraction of the total volume and so on. So it's not obvious to me that we've folded in all the selection effects along the lines of temperature and stuff like that. And hence that we're actually seeing anything approximating an estimate of the total omega of metals in the universe at that time. Right? Lots are still in galaxies, lots are hot, the selection effects are there and stuff like that. So I want to see the simulations exactly match the data in the sense of the B values. And well, in the sense of the, yeah, in the sense of the clumping, I want to see you get the clumping right, the carbon 4 offset from the hydrogen H1, stuff like that really bothers me in terms of ionization. Yeah, so I claim we're not there yet.
Well, maybe I'm too naive, but it seems to me that the one way to explain this constancy of the metallicity is just that you allow small galaxies that are forming early, which we know are easy, are very able at ejecting the metals, and then where the characteristic mass grows and then the metals are retained, then you don't see any change, exactly as Len is saying. So you can't accumulate more because these large galaxies do not eject their metals, and this is exactly what we see at low redshift, at least in the Sloan survey, where we see, as we were discussing yesterday, that the metallicity mass relation is decreasing below a certain mass very rapidly.
Anybody else? Well, we're done today.